Our first speaker is Professor David Kraling from the School of Pharmacy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His office is right on the other end of State Street here on the Madison campus. He's also affiliated with our co-sponsor, the Sonderegger Research Center for Social and Administrative Pharmacy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He spent a tremendous amount of time helping us plan this seminar and prepare the briefing report, as has his colleague, Professor Dave Mott, and I want to publicly thank both of them for their counseling and advice and financial support of this seminar. He's published 30 scientific articles in the area of pharmacy economics and policy. He's published 8 reports on prescription drugs, including the Kaiser Family Foundation's Prescription Drug Trends, a chart book, which we featured at our January seminar. It's summarized in that briefing report. And on page 48 of the briefing report you got today, there's ordering information on the web address for the full copy of the full report. Dr. Kraling has conducted briefings on prescription drugs for legislative staff on Capitol Hill, for policymakers, for researchers, for media representatives, for foundation staff, for corporate pharmacy executives, and for pharmacy practitioners. He's received a Teaching Excellence Award and also awards on 2 of his research papers. And before entering academia, he worked as a pharmacist. Now, I do a lot of research, as you know, on my speakers before I invite them in, and sometimes I come across some very interesting things that are not on their formal resume. So I have from a very good source that he has another area of expertise. He has a solid reputation in his department for getting the very best deal on conference motels. Is that true? I hear that he never fails to get the best location with the most amenities at the cheapest rate. So I'm wondering if you'd like to join our committee and help us get motels for our seminars. His topic today, though, is his primary area of expertise, which is prescription drugs. What strategies can states use to control costs, and how effective are they? Professor Kraling.
Thank you. She warned me that she was going to do a little zinger like that and do something funny to get started, and I didn't know what was coming off because I didn't feed her with anything, so thanks, Dave. That could have been worse. I want to take a few minutes with you this morning and share with you some thoughts that are derived from the a paper that I did as a background paper for a DHHS conference that was held in August. And at that conference, I had 10 minutes, so I've got twice as much time, but it still will be very fast, some of the things that I want to try to cover. My slides are duplicated, I believe, in a handout as well, and I'll highlight a few things in here. I won't have time to talk about all cost control strategies that have been used. And the paper that I initially wrote was a paper that was designed to focus on PBM efforts to control costs. But in reality, whatever PBMs do to control costs are the same kind of things that states potentially have available to them, with the exception of the fact that with Medicaid programs, if we want to think about applying the cost control methods to Medicaid programs, we have a different kind of population that might not have the income to be able to afford co-payments and so on and so forth. So you have some limitations for some of those efforts. But my goal is first to make sure I can – this one, right? This one. This? Ooh, okay. My goal this morning is to try to describe and discuss some cost control methods and their effects and implications. And before I begin, I do want to note that there are some caveats with cost control methods. One of those is that strategies will often overlap, or they'll be used not necessarily in isolation. So it'll be things that will be put together. You might have a formulary, but at the same time with that formulary will be things like differential copayments to help drive drugs to the formulary products that you want to use. The second point that's a kind of a warning is that when we look at the literature around cost control area and cost control techniques, the literature is incomplete and it's inconclusive, in part because of who funds studies and their motivations in that how the study was done and who was reporting in on that creates some challenges for us to really have clear-cut answers with things in terms of literature research and the foundation for some of these things. And the last is that all the efforts and the techniques have some warts. They all have some shortcomings. It can cause some unintended effects. And part of what I want to do this morning is talk not only about what can happen, but also on the positive side, but what also might be things that you might not expect to happen that might be on the downside. So the bottom line for me is that I don't have a complete, solid one answer to say, do this because this is what will do it, because I'm not sure there is such an answer that's out there. But I'd like to share some thoughts and some insights about how they happen and how they work. Next. This one? Yes, yeah. Maybe not. By Pat? Pat Penn? Oh, push it for me, Meg, would you please? Okay. What we want to... Oh, she does get the dog.
Meg is good.
There must be some interference.
Not so good.
Yeah, that's right. I have my limitations, that's for sure. To talk about cost control strategies, I kind of put them somewhat arbitrarily, but into two categories that will help us kind of organize our thinking about them. And I have things that I call sort of pricing mechanisms that include pharmacy discounts, and I lump mail order into that because mail order typically is a deeper discount approach to the providers that you include in your networks and so forth. And secondly, rebates. And the second area that I kind of lump things together is sort of utilization-targeted efforts and strategies that focus on utilization that include formularies, generic substitution, DUR, disease management type things, and I have last but not least, copayments and coinsurance. When we think about the pricing strategies, the approach and the thought behind the pricing idea is that we're doing volume purchasing, and so we can extract better prices from our suppliers, if you will. And the target for pricing strategies are the providers. And providers we use, we might say providers in quotes, they're pharmacy providers, which we typically think of as providers. But we can also think of manufacturers sort of as being providers in this arena. And so you target some pricing efforts at them. What you want to do in terms of one of the techniques is to do discounts with pharmacies and try to extract lower prices from your pharmacy providers. So establish different ingredient cost rates or dispensing fees within the pharmacy payment formula for reimbursement. And when we do that, we have some issues or some parameters that we need to keep in mind. When we do try to apply discounts, they're constrained, if you will, by the acceptance of the market, the acceptance of the providers to accept those lower rates. And you're dependent upon them accepting those and taking those rates and moving forward with them. There also is this, some challenges. Whoops, go back, please. That we can't do. But that's okay, you can stay there. There also is the problem that with the volume pricing approach, you get a volume mentality. And that means that you may be looking at trying to make a service provision into a commodity type approach, and it may not completely fit. There are some limitations in service industries to making volume happen, because when you're doing service industries and when you're doing a service product, that's dependent upon the personnel typically, unless it's an equipment-based service. But for the most part, healthcare services as we know them today are people-based, and there's only so many consultations, for example, that a pharmacist can make in an hour, because that's limited by the time that it takes to educate that consumer, that patient. And you can't make more of those happen just by cranking up the volume or lowering the price and expecting that to happen. So although it's based on the premise of economies of scale, so there are some challenges with forcing volume-type thinking and volume approaches in service industries. Okay. So just quickly, some of the intended effects are that you want to decrease the price or lower the price or effectively the margin, if you will, in a pharmacy situation on a given prescription, and you want to foster efficiencies to the extent that they can occur within pharmacies. At the same time, you can have some downsides that include reduced access to pharmacies. If you lower the price so far that pharmacies don't participate, you're not going to have access to patients, to pharmacies, to patients in the pharmacies. And secondarily, if pharmacists are so busy, or the personnel in pharmacies are so busy merely dispensing prescriptions, they might not have time to have contact with their patients and the pharmacist in that interaction that might be very, very crucial in solving drug problems, making sure drugs are taken appropriately, might be reduced and almost eliminated. Part of that is sort of an automatized, what I call an automatized drug profile review, where the time to really provide some scrutiny and understand particularly complex therapies that patients may have is often minimized, and that can create problems in itself. There's a question about, and I have a question mark here on the slide, that maybe there's a question of whether we trade off effectiveness for efficiency, and that if it takes a few minutes to review a complex drug therapy profile that a patient may have, and instead we focus on making sure that we just get prescriptions dispensed, if we don't have the time to stop and say, why are we taking all seven of these drugs, and is there a way we can get down from seven to three and still have therapeutic effects that we're after, have we compromised by being efficient with our dispensing but not effective with what drugs we're using and how we're using them? So that also may provide missed opportunities for lower total costs, because some of the assessment, some of the thinking, the time effort that may go into evaluating drug use may focus on lower total cost by reducing excess drugs, by making the right cost-effective choices, and so forth. A second pricing type technique are rebates. Rebates are in a way they're pricing, but in a way they're not, because they're aftermarket deals. They happen, as we all know, with rebates. You buy something and you send the form in, and later you get the money back. They bypass the retailers effectively. The rebates don't go to pharmacies, but they go back to the sponsors, and the state Medicaid folks can tell us an awful lot about that. I won't spend a lot of time with that. But effectively, the price comes back. They're constrained by the best price clause within OBRA. OBRA 90 specified that if you have a rebate in place, if it's not with the Medicaid program, if the rebate you offer is better than what Medicaid now gets, you have to add to your rebate to compensate for that best price. Another problem with rebates is that typically now they are not earned only by volume. You can't go to a drug manufacturer and say, well, we represent so many people. They're going to say, so? They're going to say, we'll give a rebate, but we're going to focus on affecting market share. And the rebates will be connected with the ability to move market share to their products. And so this is one of the places where strategies are confounded, that there may be a rebate, but it might also be mixed with a formulary and a differential copayment to try to drive use to that products. And typically we see rebates focused on and used and applied to brand name drugs. So there's some challenges with that. The positive side of the things that you want to try to accomplish with rebates is to decrease your program cost by lowering prices on the rebated drugs and to increase those drugs' use. The downside is that it drives drug use to brand name drugs. And that may de-emphasize lower cost options, and or the total cost picture may actually be overlooked. So there's some challenges with rebates that, although they really sound great and it's a way to get at, if you will, the manufacturers, and a lot of people really like that jazzy approach and being able to try to accomplish that, it really is not real successful. So let me just walk through real quickly a rebate example to show you kind of how that works and some of the scars or the warts that they may have. And I want to ask you, which is better? The first option is to say, we've got a plan where we're treating 100 patients and there's no rebate in place. 30 of those patients take a $100 drug, an expensive drug, and 70 of those patients are treated with a second drug, drug B, that's only $30. The total cost, when we put that together, 30 people at $100 and 70 people at $30, the total cost of that drug use, the overall program, is $5,100. If instead we have a rebate and we're treating those same 100 people, and we have a 20% rebate for the drug A, the expensive drug, and that changes because there's the market share impact that goes with that. That changes so that we now have 50 people treated with drug A and 50 people with drug B, even though we're buying drug A now at $80 at a 20% discount, which actually, to be honest, is a pretty high rebate relative to what's out there right now. But even at $80 at a 20% rebate, when we take 50 people instead of 30 before, and 50 people at 30, we find that the total cost actually goes up. So it's a way of kind of exemplifying the fact that you need to be careful what you're buying when you get a rebate, because if you're moving your products to the more expensive use or used to more expensive products, you may not be capturing what you want to have happen. So I wanted to do this and just quickly walk through that. If we move next to the kind of things that are utilization strategies, I want to highlight a few of those. The approach is to influence which drugs are used and how many drugs are used. That's the whole idea of utilization. And the target in this case is patients a lot of times, because they are the ones that utilize, but also providers, either pharmacies or prescribers, and they happen in different ways that they'll connect with that. One of those to be used is obviously a formulary, and a definition of formulary, a simple definition, is it's a list of drugs that's approved or covered or reimbursed under a drug plan. You specify which products you're going to pay for effectively when you have a drug plan. And that list, that formulary, can vary both by the breadth in terms of the breadth of drugs, the variety and the assortment of drugs that are available, as well as the difficulty that might be present in obtaining certain drugs. For example, the openness or the restrictiveness of a formulary. An open formulary will allow pretty much access to everything that's available, very broad, very easy access to a wide variety of drugs. A restrictive formulary will say, well, no, in a certain therapeutic category, we're only going to offer one or two choices. And so if there are six options available in terms of different drugs within a therapeutic category or a therapeutic class, if you will, and it's a similar therapeutic effect, maybe we'll only offer one or two that are available. And I think most of us are at this stage of the game in Madison anyway, and throughout the state, I think most of us have experienced this with the private plans that we participate in, that we've had some restrictiveness, and we've experienced that in our own use. The The issues with formularies is the level and the amount or the degree to which we restrict the access, the notion that there often can be these rebate requirements that go together with the preferred drugs. And to get drugs on a formulary, get them in a preferred status, often within the private side, and the way that most likely would happen with a state plan is that if you want to negotiate to get rebates, these manufacturers can say, well, if you want me to rebate my product, you got to give me something too, so let's get some market share out of that. Okay, so there's that connection with that. And the other issue is the ability to provide access to other drugs in terms of what do you do or how are the techniques available for people that are prescribed and or need off-formulary products. Can they be accessed and how does that happen? The intended effects of formularies are to drive drugs sometimes I have trouble with my mouth also. The intended effects are to drive use to those desired drugs. Those drugs that are on the formulary are the ones that you want to have used. And selection of drugs for formulary is not just a cost issue. It should not be just a cost issue. And most pharmacy and therapeutic committees that select formularies and build them will focus on the clinical aspects first and secondarily the cost. Because it doesn't make any sense to have a drug on formulary that clinically is not good, even if the cost profile is great for you. Because you're going to end up with bigger problems if you have the wrong drugs on your formulary. But the intended effect is to drive use to those desired drugs, and you control access to the expensive drugs, the ones that you don't want on the formulary, by restrictions such as prior authorization, which is a procedure that requires access to be garnered by authorization of a physician or prescriber to allow that and have a secondary approval of that. The unintended effects of formularies that we can sometimes see is that we have this brand name preference that happens and creeps up in formularies, in part because of the connection of rebates with formularies as well. And in a way, it can divert from sort of that total cost perspective again. Kind of keeping your eye on the wrong target can be a problem for us. A second utilization effort that I want to speak about, and probably the one that I think our state administrators would contend in this state as well as elsewhere, the one that's gotten the most bang for the buck, is generic substitution. In the last seminar, you learned that the average price of a brand name drug is about three times as much as a generic drug. So if you can trade a generic drug for a brand drug, there's considerable savings there to be had. And the way generic substitution works is that there are incentives in place either for the pharmacist in terms of the payments and a differential fee, maybe a little higher payment for a generic drug on the pharmacist, or for the patients in terms of their cost sharing, they may have a lower cost sharing amount for a generic drug to move the drugs into that use. And I just said that, so let's go to the next one, please. Sorry. Next. And what generic substitution wants to do is wants to obviously encourage use of generic drugs instead of brand name drugs because of the cost differential and the savings that are there. The unintended effects that sometimes occur is that the incentives are often too small. In my own health plan, I have a $5 generic copayment and a $10 brand name drug copayment. And what incentive? Is that really enough of incentive for me to select a generic as opposed to a brand name drug? I might argue probably not. And if it's a less differential than that, it's even worse. So the incentives are often too small to motivate significant changes. And they also don't signal real cost differences in brand versus generic drugs. A $5 versus $10 difference in copayment is not a three times or a threefold difference in the cost out of pocket to me, even though a brand and generic drug price would vary by 3%. The second way, and I'll close out with two types of cost sharing approaches. The one that we're most familiar with are copayments, where people, the consumers, pay a amount. As I mentioned in my example just before, it might be a $5 generic and a $10 brand name, and that's the way we try to focus on using drugs differently. What we've seen come up a little more recently in the last several years is the notion of a third tier, where that third copayment for your preferred or non-formulary, the products that are not preferred, get ratcheted up. So we may have a $5 for generic, $10 for brand, and $25, $30, or even I've seen this in the literature as high as $45 copayment for a non-formulary, non-preferred brand drug. And the challenges with this is that, as I mentioned before, is that there are relatively low contrast between them. The third tier is new, this idea of adding a third tier to help drive back to formulary products and away from those non-formulary chosen ones. It's really not sure what level that should be set at. Is 15 the right amount? Is 25 the right amount? And that's a challenge to understand that. And another issue that's related to copayments is whether consumers accept, and even the sponsors accept, the copayments and the amounts that are there. If we think of, for a second, about the intended effects, obviously, if the consumer's paying part of the cost, it's going to decrease the sponsor's cost. So what the consumer may pay, if we're talking about a state program, that reduces what the cost of the state has to pay, and it shifts the costs over. And it can sensitize consumers in a way to the cost of their drug use. The unintended effects that happen is that we see generic drugs de-emphasized a lot of times because of that relatively low cost differential. I mean, in my own case, well, for $5, why not? You know? And there also is relatively reduced consumer awareness of drug resource use. Even though they're intended to sensitize them to their use, it doesn't really do a good job of sensitizing them or making them aware of how really different costs of drugs are. So a second approach to do cost sharing is to do co-insurance, where the consumer or the patient is asked to pay a percentage of the cost, 20 or 30%, or in some of the Medicare proposals that we've seen on the federal level, a 50%, which is pretty heavy duty. And you can vary that percent for the brand versus generic drugs. What we don't know is that, or some of the problems that come up with this, is that in the past, a lot of sponsors, for example, employers and unions, have liked to have a predictability in the out-of-pocket that consumers see when they go to the pharmacy. And so a copayment allows that because it's an amount that's fixed. A coinsurance, although the rate is fixed, it can vary. If you have a $20 drug and it's a percentage of that, you pay a whole different amount than if it's a $100 drug and you pay a percentage of that, the same percentage. And that unpredictability to be able to say to a consumer or someone, you know automatically what your copay or how much your out-of-pocket is going to be, that causes some challenges with that, as well as the concern about what's the appropriate rate of the copayment. We've seen 20% a lot of time in the public side, in the private side, and with indemnity type plans, that's a very common cost share, 20-80, with the patient paying 20 and the insurer paying 80%. The Medicare proposals, some of them have been at 50%, but the question is what percentage is the right amount. The issues with those, the intended effects are, again, to shift some of those costs to the consumer, and it makes them sensitive to their drug resource use. People will feel the price of a $100 drug differently than a $40 drug if they're paying a percentage. And the downside is that people may avoid high-cost drugs when they might be needed. And so there can be a negative to this one as well, and it also makes mail service pretty impractical. So she's given me the stop sign, so I'm going to stop. I've been through my techniques that I wanted to cover. There's a summary slide in the handout, as well as some charts that show or raise some questions about if these things have been in place, which they have for several years, in our cost control strategies, why are we still seeing costs basically growing the way that they have been? It almost renders them ineffective, or we could conclude that they almost are. But we need to think about their promise and putting together a good package.
Stay here for a second. No, that's right. He has an excellent summary of this in his chapter in the briefing report. On page 8, a graph that sort of summarizes the advantages and disadvantages, which I think is very good. We're going to take 5 minutes of questions for Dr. Kraling. And Jessica has the mic. Anyone have a question? There's one in the back. You need to speak into the mic because we audio tape these for legislators who commute long distances.
I was just wondering if there's any kind of standard definition for generic substitutions in terms of chemically. Are these actually the exact same drugs? And if so, why would you choose a $10 brand name?
Well, in most cases, the way generic substitution is now put in place. Let me answer your question first. Generics are equivalent. They're the same chemical in the same dosage form. And so you'll get the same chemical, the same salt, the same strength. They are equivalent products. And Steve's reminding me to make sure I say, and same quality. Indeed, the FDA does warrant that their bioavailability or the availability to the bloodstream is the same for generic versus a brand name drug. And if you have the choice, would you make a brand versus a generic? Some people will. Some people have brand recognition. It's the same reason why OTC products are available. You can buy Walgreens guaifenesin syrup for your cough, but you'll recognize and probably take Robitussin because you're comforted by that name. Okay? And some people, as well as some prescribers, put weight on that brand name as well as what they perceive the quality difference that a brand may provide, which may or may not be there. What typically happens, though, is that plans are set up that if a generic's available you have to take the generic or pay the cost difference. And that's the thing that really drives to the generic use. But what that also says to me is that if I'm a consumer and I don't really think generics are as good, that I have a perception about that, an attitude about that, whether it's right or wrong, I may say, well, you know, I don't think generics work, Doc. Is there something else I can have? And so that would say, oh, yeah, we've got something that's new and different. Let's try that instead.
I guess I would just have one concern. I work with senior citizens that have told me that they've been switched to generics without their even knowing about it, and knew it weeks later when they were getting different side effects and different effectiveness. Are those not truly generics as you're talking about them? Is that the problem?
They should be, but every person's individual response to a drug and how it works is individual, as individual as our character, our personalities. And that may be a situation where, for whatever reason, how that drug was put together, although the FDA says these are equivalent, it might not always be. Okay, so some of those happen, but the universality might not always be there, that occurring. Pharmacists can switch, and it's automatic unless it's prohibited on the prescription order by the words "do not substitute" in Wisconsin.
Another question.
Just
we need to have you speak in the mic.
Can you more clearly define, I guess, what you mean by equivalent versus identical? That is, are these drugs not entirely identical, or in what ways might a generic drug not be identical to a brand name drug?
In 30 seconds. Okay, we can do this real quick. You can buy GE light bulbs. You can buy Sylvania light bulbs. You can also go to Menards and get ShopPro or Menards. Okay? Are those products identical? They're equivalent. 100-watt bulb's a 100-watt bulb. They should do the same thing and put out the same light. But you may have a perception, or there may be some longevity. Who knows? But they are equivalent. They are supposed to be, and they're warranted equivalent. The FDA says if they're, the bioavailability must be within a 20% range, plus or minus 20, of the standard, which typically is the brand name. There have been cases where generic products have come on board that have been better than the brand names, more bioavailable. And so there were some changes that had to happen with generics for diazide several years back because of that.
FDA standard for generics versus brand names requires there be no more difference between the brand and the generic than there is between one lot of the brand and the next lot of the brand. So unless people worry about which lot number of the brand you're getting each time, generics won't vary more. The one difference that is there is some of the inactive ingredients. For example, a few people, less than a tenth of a percent of the population, has a reaction to dyes like yellow dye or blue dye. And you may have a brand that's blue and a generic that's yellow. If the patient's allergic to blue, they're allergic to the brand and it's not as good. If they're allergic to yellow, they're allergic to generic, it's not good. So there are a few rare exceptions where it makes a minor difference, but those patients are known and have allergies that have been identified and that can be managed.
In general, when generics are available in the market today, 80 plus, probably 90, close to 90% of prescriptions, if a generic's available, is now being used with generics. Generics are being dispensed. And so the issues in the cases that occur are some of these oddities, usually, rather than the norm. And so you have to be a little careful about critical incidents, just like critical incidents anywhere, and think more about, is this sort of the exception or the rule? And more often than not, it's the exception, and we need to be careful with that.
Good. Thank you.